Great. Well, it's nice to be back with you again, and this group actually prompted me to print this. I had this just sitting on my computer, the various chapters from Ethan Allen's Reason, the Only Oracle of Man, and since I didn't even suggest that we talk about the Enlightenment, but you did, so I thought, well, this is a chance to share what I consider to be a rare gem of the frontier Enlightenment in colonial America, which is washed up somehow on the shores of Lake Champlain from France and England, and is seen through the perspective of a genuine eccentric Ethan Allen, because there's no other way to describe him. He really was an unusual man. And most famous, as I say in the introduction, for his military exploits, but he was really, he considered himself a frontier philosopher. And he wanted to drive false religion and superstition out of the country, just the way he wanted to drive the British out. So I use the analogy of him in battle, you know, going out and attacking the enemy, as it were. So before I get to this, though, perhaps we should talk about the Enlightenment in general, just to sort of set it up. And I realize that you know a lot about it, probably to begin with. My interest here mainly is in the Enlightenment as it relates to history of religions, because the Enlightenment has got probably two or three different aspects to it, and the one that is probably most celebrated and talked about is the political side of the Enlightenment, because that's really what brought us our democracy in the United States and really transformed the world. That type of thinking changed France, for sure, and England, and really all of the major world powers at that time. And there's also an industrial, sort of a military-industrial side of the Enlightenment, too, because that goes along with the scientific advances that came with the Enlightenment. So those are two big branches of it. And then the third, which is related, is the history of religions aspect of it. And so that's really what I wanted to talk about today, because that leads right into Ethan Allen's work, which is what I hope to talk about. So when we look back at the forces of the Enlightenment, what caused this? Well, first of all, where did the word come from, Enlightenment?
It's
small.
Huh? French.
It's actually, it came from German. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is a German word I won't pronounce. No, I won't even try, because I would butcher it. But it's a word, because the Enlightenment appeared in Germany as well as in France and England. And the slogan of the Enlightenment, according to Immanuel Kant, is dare to know, which he used in Latin, odere sape, or something along those lines, dare to know. In other words, try to look reality in the face without rose-colored glasses or any colored glasses. Dare to know the truth. And this covers all fields, so not just philosophical or religious matters, but scientific as well. And so that's how the Enlightenment sort of precipitated the changes that we're talking about. And the changes basically were to overthrow the existing political authority and replace it with more democratic structures, and to challenge the authority of the church, which has already been challenged, of course, in the earlier period of the Reformation and the growth of Protestantism. So the Enlightenment sort of grew out of Protestantism. It's sort of Protestantism taken one step beyond, if you will. And there is, I would like to recommend a general book called The Portable Enlightenment Reader, which is another one of these Viking portable books, which I love. I mean, they're just, and this particular one is fairly recent, and it's edited by Isaac Kramnik. There's a picture of Benjamin Franklin on the cover, and symbolic of the Enlightenment, you know, playing with the lightning, actually. And it's a good overview. It's not particularly strong in history of religions, but it's definitely there. And some of the major thinkers are mentioned here. Now, who are the major thinkers when we talk about the religious tradition related to the Enlightenment? These are names that are not too familiar to us today. The first is really a man named Lord Herbert of Shrewsbury. Has anyone ever heard of Lord Herbert of Shrewsbury, who died in 1648? No? Well, let me tell you, he's an interesting guy, very interesting guy, because in order to talk about religion then, you had to sort of couch it in a lot of different, guises, as it were. And he wrote a book called Pagan Religion. Actually, he wrote it in Latin. It's so long ago that he actually wrote this book in Latin. And he was an aristocrat, as you might imagine, Lord Herbert would be. And what he did, when he was thinking of pagan religion here, he was really talking about pre-Christian Greco-Roman religion. He's talking about the myths of the Greeks and the Romans, really. And he ends up writing what is considered by scholars to be the first work in comparative religion. That's what makes it so interesting for me, because comparative religion is what I spent years studying. So this is the book that sort of set the stage for it. And curious to note, it's actually well written. It's a good book, and it's still in print. There's a little publishing house in Canada that has the title, and I actually bought one, so I know it's still in print. And it's a good translation, because obviously I couldn't read the Latin. It's been a long time since I studied Latin, but he doesn't directly talk about Christianity, but he reveals parallels between Christianity and Greco-Roman religion, and talks about the fundamental religious needs of mankind. It's a good book. And it influenced, there's sort of a cascading effect among the British deists, they're called deists primarily, that work influenced the others like Charles Blount and John Toland and John Locke and David Hume and all of, there's a cascading effect because they all seem to read each other's books. They were keenly interested in this. And now, Lord Herbert himself did not claim to be a deist, but that's the term that was given to him. And the understanding there is that they do believe in God, for sure, mm-hmm. but tend to be Unitarians and not put any credence in supernatural revelation. Now, when you look up deism in the book, the dictionary or something, frequently it will say something like a belief in an absentee God, someone that set up the world and then absconded. Or the idea of a clockwork universe, that the deity made the universe and then is allowing it to tick away in terms of the natural laws that were set up. But what I'd like to say to you is that they're all different kinds and varieties of deism. It's not an exact term at all. And, you know, like our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, Franklin, and Washington to some extent, and certainly Madison and a whole bunch of the others that we consider our, you know, the founding spirits of the country, were all deists. That was the popular intellectual view of religion in the late 18th century. And it grew out of the English deist, going back to Lord Herbert of Shrewsbury. I love just saying that name. I mean, it just sort of rolls off, Lord Herbert of Shrewsbury.
I sort of like the condensing of it to Lord Sherbert.
Lord Sherbert.
Herbert of
Sherbert. Lord Sherbert of Orange.
And so the reason I got interested in Ethan Allen, and particularly this book, is last summer I read this book, which is a new book called Freethinkers, History of American Secularism by Susan Jacoby. And I had actually read something of hers on the internet that piqued my interest, where she talks about the pervasiveness of this deism in early American culture. And in the first chapter, she actually talks about Ethan Allen. And so I said, wow, this is kind of interesting. She says, the fundamental ethos of the revolution was opposed to divine as well as earthly despotism. Quote, who would imagine, the Revolutionary War hero Ethan Allen asked in 1784, that the deity conducts his providence similar to the detestable despots of the world? Oh, horrible, oh, most horrible impeachment of divine goodness. To Allen, better known today as the leader of the Green Mountain Boys and an advocate of statehood for Vermont, a rejection of the all-powerful Calvinistic deity went together with a rejection of the divine right of kings. The Reverend Timothy Dwight, president of Yale, would play a leading role in the concerted efforts to reestablish religious orthodoxy in the post-revolutionary nation, described Allen's Reason, the Only Oracle of Man as, quote, the first formal publication in the United States openly directed against the Christian religion, end quote. A disorganized and stylistically clumsy writer, Allen never achieved the influence or notoriety that accompanied the dissemination of Paine's The Age of Reason a decade later. But she says, this book, despite its rough-hewn style, offers considerable insight into the revolutionary connection between political and religious freedom. And then goes on to mention the book several times later there. So that kind of piqued my interest because I had never come across this book. And so my first effort was simply to get a copy to read, and I couldn't find one. Mm-hmm. And so I went, did a search on the internet and found that I could get an abridged version of it, which I got. And that was very interesting, but a little frustrating because it's hard to read too. And fairly long. I mean, it's a little over 100 pages. And so then I went to track down the original, and there are some originals. UVM actually has several. And then there's a facsimile edition as well. But somehow seeing the book, I went to the State Archives in Barrie and actually saw the book. They took it out in a box, you know, and presented it to me. And it's this leather-bound book. And I had this strange feeling about it, that this was really an interesting thing, a curiosity, as it were. Although I say it's more than a literary curiosity here, it seemed to have a kind of a, I don't know, a presence to it, the book itself. Because they call it Ethan Allen's Bible, because it looked like a Bible. I mean, it's leather-bound, although this particular edition was quite worn. And also I had visited with Ethan Allen Sims, who used to be a... actually, he was the director of the Clinical Research Center here years ago, and he's a direct descendant of Ethan Allen, and he has a copy, too. And he showed me his copy out at Wake Robin one day when we were talking about this project. And so I got this kind of curious feel about the book itself, you know, that this was something that needed to be better known. And also, quite frankly, I was looking for something to do besides my job, to tell you the truth. I mean, with all the everything that's going on, I needed to be engaged in some project that I felt was worthwhile. That's just a fact. And I, as you know, my background is mainly studying Eastern religions, and I just didn't have any vocation. Nothing was calling me in that area. It's not to say that I know it all. By any means, I don't know it all. But just nothing was calling me to study Sanskrit or come out with some sort of scholarly article about the Bhagavad Gita or something like that. It just wasn't. I wasn't getting that call. But all of a sudden, this strange book was sort of calling me, saying, you know, wrestle with me for a while. See what you get out of this. So that's what I did. And when I started with the chapters, I was just transcribing them to see if I could get the essence of the message of each chapter out. And I did the ones that you've read here, although this is a little bit less than the total thing. I mean, I've cut it down even to get to this size. And so I tried to interest several publishing houses in publishing it, because I felt like I had a real, you know, find on my hand. My father and I, when I was a kid, used to go around and look for old cars. He was a great enthusiast of antique cars. And we used to go out to old barns in northern New Jersey, and we could always seem to find old cars. And sometimes he would buy them, and sometimes he wouldn't. But I had this feeling of almost a deja vu effect of finding an old car that was sitting in a barn that hadn't been restored. You know, it was just sitting there waiting for somebody to sort of spruce it up a little bit. And even in the preface, Ethan says, you know, I leave it to abler writers to complete this project. And I read that and I said, whoa, I don't know if he's talking to me or what. So I took it upon myself to try to find a publisher for this. And so far, I've struck out completely. And I don't know why. I hope that in this version, the booklet version, maybe I'll have more luck if they can see that there is potential here. But it still is a controversial book.
So did you publish this yourself?
Yeah, it's entirely self-published.
Where did the illustrations come from? They look like woodcuts.
They are. They're from the 18th, 19th century. So they're just... I wanted to make it a little more like a farmer's almanac, give it a country feel to it a little bit.
Why did the publishers not be interested?
I don't know. I have... Some of them don't say... I will. I haven't...
I would think there'd be lots of interest in it.
Maybe there will be. It just so far there hasn't been. So let's actually talk about the book itself then, shall we? If that's enough of a preamble on it. Ethan, well, first of all, was the introduction helpful? I tried to sort of set the stage for it there, more or less what I just told you, although I didn't mention how I came upon the book.
Now, when you say that you saw this book in Barry, is that the first edition?
Yeah.
And would there have been other books of the first edition? Is that what they have at the university as well?
Yep. They were originally, I believe, 1,500 printed in Bennington, which he, as I say, went into debt for, because he couldn't find a publisher either. Now, what's interesting about that is he had, when he got out of prison, he actually wrote a narrative of his captivity, which is in print, and that's a very interesting little book. What's interesting for me is that it confirms the writing style is the same, because definitely you can see the writing style and the narrative of my captivity and this are the same. And that was fairly popular work. It was serialized, I believe, in like magazines, and a lot of people read that. And so I think maybe he was encouraged by that to publish this one, but discouraged by the fact that he couldn't find a publisher, and that even though he was land rich, he had thousands of acres of land, he was money poor. And he actually had to borrow from Ira and some other sources and use his pay from the Continental Army to publish this book. So he really went way out on a limb to get it published. And then there was a fire, actually, after the book was printed, that destroyed a number of copies, and I don't know how many, because this is all lost. And the Calvinist ministers claim that this was divine retribution to wipe out the book. And I don't know how many actually got out into the circulation. Not more than 1,000, anyway. And of which there may be 24, 25 in existence today. So that's, and there was never a second edition of that edition. He had written an addendum, an 80-page addendum to, he was a very prolific writer, to the original in order to further explain his views of the soul. He was very interested in the soul, in fact, in the immortality of the soul. That is the crucial part of this whole enterprise. And, curiously enough, the abridged edition, which you can get out on the internet, omits that chapter completely. It's not there at all. And I wondered why, because that is the central chapter of the book, really. That's why, in a sense, one author says that's why he wrote the book. He was wrestling with immortality, and he wanted to, because he saw, you know, obviously in colonial life as well as in today, life is very short, and he saw, he lost his first wife and a number of relatives, and he was feeling the pinch of mortality, I think. And so a lot of this is his own ruminations on mortality. But that is the key. That's the key passage. So that was another inspiration for me, or prod, to come out with a shorter version that had that in that, because I felt like if somebody read the whole abridged version and think they really understood it, they're missing the point. they're bound to miss the point because they left out this key chapter. So anyway, that's now the addendum. The only thing I used from the addendum is the very last couple of paragraphs as the postscript, and in that it doesn't take much to see that he's become a little misanthropic, partly because I think he was discouraged by the reception that he almost felt like the book would change the world. Mm-hmm. You have that feeling, and he had that sort of character, like, I'm going to drive false religion out of the country. And it didn't. In fact, it was ridiculed. He was called the clodhopper philosopher and a heretic and all kinds of nasty things. And, of course, that he had a thick skin, and certainly he would have fought anyone, you know. And I'm sure that the ministers were like this because they didn't want to go and challenge him directly. But I think he was discouraged by the reception the book had. And it didn't